You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo today as my co-host extraordinaire, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox, is attending with one of her clients, but she will be back next week. And each week, we will bring you, all of you, listeners, guests, all of you, we will bring you answers and options that will really bring you the type of guests that I think will help us entertain, just whatever answers and options you have. And our main goal is the fact that we are all trying to raise our children today in the way in which we would like to see them raised, and we want to continue that throughout our changing future. Now, we're going to address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. And now, with having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we're going to continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, today, we're going to be discussing our current healthcare system. Now, if you've been concerned about the direction healthcare reform is moving in our country, then just keep listening. Our guest today will show us how to stay healthy and avoid the pitfalls of a deteriorating U.S. healthcare system. Now, our guest, Dr. Craig Beyer, has been a practicing ophthalmologist and LASIK surgeon for more than 20 years. Having experienced both the reward of helping patients achieve optimum health as well as kind of the hell of seeing government intervention and special interest work directly against his patients' health and financial well-being. From 1995 to 1998, Dr. Beyer was CEO of MedNet International, a company that trained, financed, and established modern eye centers in the People's Republic of China. And prior to that, Dr. Beyer was a member of the team that performed the first laser vision correction procedure in the world, as well as one of the first to perform experimental LASIK surgery in 1988. Dr. Beyer's current practice operates within the Boulder, Colorado area, where he performs general ophthalmology and what's called eye LASIK, which is the latest refinement in the procedure he helped pioneer more than two decades ago. Dr. Beyer, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Well, I'm glad to have you, and I just want our listeners to know that we're not just going to be talking about eye surgery or LASIK or anything else. And one of the reasons is that Dr. Beyer has a book out, and I've read about half of it so far, and it's called Heaven or Health. And the more I got into it, the more I realized that we needed to get you on the air, because I think that you're shining a light on some things that a lot of people aren't realizing. I think they're out there listening to sort of a political rhetoric that goes on without really knowing exactly what's going on as it relates to our health care.
Yep, I totally agree with you. And as I was listening to the introduction of your show about watching out for the youth in this country, that is really one of my prime motivators. When I see that so much of our tax dollars and the way that we are placing such a burden on the younger generation, and it's a totally avoidable burden, but we keep continuing to stack mounting debt on this generation and decreasing their opportunities for their own individual and future growth and the benefits of what they can receive from education, it totally frustrates me. And then I'm even more frustrated when I see the youth, listening to this rhetoric and not really understanding what's behind the rhetoric and where it's really going.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. But I think what we, I mean, let's go right into, I mean, what do you see as really the, I mean, the biggest hurdle that we're having to deal with, and what's the most important thing in our lives right now?
Well, I think the most important thing is in our lives is basically our life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when it comes down to it, you could ask, and this is really something that I borrowed from Bikram, you know, a famous yoga instructor out of Los Angeles, and he set up Bikram yoga classes. But that's how he usually starts his classes. What's the most important thing in your life? And people would say, well, it's my family, it's God, it's, you know, financial issues. But really it comes down to it. If you don't have your life, you're not much in tune with anything else. You can't support your family. You can't believe in God. You can't do anything. That comes first. So well, I think people have to realize that's the number one priority. And every morning you should wake up and figure out, how can I take care of my life first?
Yep. And that's interesting that you bring that up. And I noticed that in reading the book that it was one of your first quotes. And I also do Bikram yoga. So I am here in Los Angeles. So.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
Now, with that said, I mean, at what point did you really think, you know, I'm frustrated enough about, you know, what's going on out there that you decided to write a book? Why write a book about it? You know, and again, for those that haven't read it, first of all, I highly recommend it. If you want to educate yourself to learn about what's really going on in this area, I highly recommend it, because there's a lot of things, you know, from a statistical standpoint. So this wasn't, you know, as I was reading it, I didn't see it and go, you know, well, this is sort of the view of an ophthalmologist or whatever. I mean, I think, you know, you really go into, you know, the financial aspects of it, the long-term healthcare aspects of it. So it's very, very thorough. So why take the time away from your practice and write a book like this?
Well, let me just go ahead, too. I'm going to post my talking points, too, for people that don't want to spend the time reading the entire book. The talking points, I'll post it on our website at www.heavenorhealth, and it's health.org. So I'll get those on there, too, and that'll pretty much summarize key points in the book. But the reason why I wrote it, I think the tipping point was in March of 2010 when the PPACA passed, which was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, that passed passed Congress on March 23rd, 2010. And I just, when I saw this thing in the making, again, it was one of those things where, oh, the rhetoric is great, insurance for all, and it just sounded like it was going to be such a great thing. But when you look between the lines and you see where we've gone and how well the government's done this in the past, for instance, with Medicare, we've already seen how Medicare is completely failing. And Medicare, you know, we are losing so much money. Just to give you an idea of how bad Medicare functions, $89 billion comes in each year in revenues, and it spends over $600 billion. So with that kind of loss, I mean, in a 600% losing subsidy for government, which, I mean, how can you imagine going into expanding this program, you know, maybe four or five fold to encompass the entire country and think that it's going to work any better? And that was my primary concern.
Now, you know, as I was just kind of glancing through some of the things, you know, in the book as well, and I know you just gave the website, you know, for anybody, if you want to sort of follow along, for those of you that are not driving now, you can go, you know, you can still keep this window open. You can go to the website and you can actually look at some of the things that we're talking about, some of the statistics right there while we're talking. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. That would be at 323-203-0815. Or you can email us. And for those of you that that get our press releases and stuff, if you email us, we will try to get your questions on as quickly as possible. So now, right now in the news, obviously, there's a big thing in regards to, you know, Obamacare, you know, and this was supposed to come in and fix all of these problems that were going on, you know, with Medicare, with our healthcare system. And I think that many of us agree, okay, it was already broke. What do you think the effects of Obamacare are going to be? And is this going to fix it, or is this going to make it worse?
Well, I think it's going to make it worse. And here's an example. I mean, look back. I don't know if you're as old as I am and you can remember the 60s and Ma Bell and AT&T and how expensive. It actually went into the 70s, too, how expensive long-distance calls were. I mean, what's happening and what our government seems to be promoting is this conglomerization of businesses and trying to make these large, non-competitive entities to drive out small businesses. And so, and when that happens, what happens is you lose quality, you lose competition, and prices start to go up. And in medicine, I'm seeing this happening as we speak, because in the, the PPACA or the Obamacare, I think Obamacare term is a little bit weighted, but, you know, that's okay, however you'd like to refer to it. Anyway, in that entity or in that act, what's happening is they're trying to save Medicare dollars by putting everybody into what's called affordable care organizations. So this is a way to support the hospitals, basically pay hospitals just like you would pay an HMO, where they would provide multi-specialty care under a fixed monthly amount. So in other words, and we're seeing this happening now, they're going to pay the hospitals more for, let's say, an angiogram in cardiology. Okay, let's say a cardiovascular surgeon in private practice says you need an angiogram for your heart. Well, instead of getting paid X amount of dollars, that they would pay to private practice, they're going to pay the hospital a little bit more. They're giving the hospital a competitive advantage and trying to drive these patients away from private practitioners. And this is happening all over the United States. You can check cardiology practices, and they are literally closing their doors because they're going out of business. They faced private practice pay cuts for, you know, over a decade now. And because of these declining reimbursement rates, they can no longer keep up with the regulation that's required, the IT requirements, everything that they need to comply with the government standards to accept Medicare. So the hospitals and the ACOs are swallowing up these doctors for basically nothing. Doctors are joining the hospitals because they have to. Now, what's going to happen when there's virtually no competition from private practice? It's going to look like what I experienced in China. So I am speaking from experience. I've seen state-run hospitals. It's not a pretty picture. These hospitals were dilapidated, and people were frightened to go to the hospitals. Now, I'm really drawing a pretty dark picture because I've seen how bad it can get when you have a state-run organization like that. But basically, what we did when we went to China was we set up a private clinic where people paid out of pocket $300 for their eye surgery instead of go to the hospital where it was basically free. Now, did you think that we had a rough time setting up business when we were able to bill for a premium intraocular lens that goes in, you know, the patient's eye after cataract surgery, do the procedure under sterile conditions with modern equipment? People were lining up at the door. So that is, you know, that is where the potential of this thing swinging totally out in the wrong direction. So I could go on with this, but this whole conglomeratization thing is an attempt to think that you're saving money. But the real problem is there's a cut that's being taken out with third-party payers and things like that, which isn't going to healthcare. And that is where all of our, even though healthcare is rising at 18% cost per year, that's where it's going. It's going to administrative costs. It's not going to the actual providing of healthcare itself.
I was going to say, and I know you touch on that in the book, and give us some kind of some statistics, some percentages, because I know that's one of the things that I think a lot of people have brought up is that, you know, we're already, you know, we had what at one time was, I mean, the best health system in the world, in the sense that people came from other countries literally to have, you know, just about any sort of procedure that they could get. I mean, if you wanted it done right, people came from other countries to the United States to get it done. I mean, that's kind of the system that we had at one time. And then now, and then we went to the insurance companies taking a cut. So now you have an administrative part with that. So now you have the government taking an administrative cut, so to speak, because of the fact that they're lumping on to the cost. And then they're handing it to the insurance companies, who are then going to take a cut. What I hear you saying is that, you know, adding more middlemen is not going to solve the problem.
That is exactly right. That is totally right. And with today's technology, it is so easy for patients to get online, determine what doctor is a good doctor or what services are provided and what their healthcare problem is, and how to address it individually without having, you know, and in the past it was more like, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'll just do whatever they tell me to do. You know, but now we have so much access to information. With just a little bit of self-motivation and direction, you can go online and start looking at things and making healthcare decisions on your own, or at least with the assistance of professionals as well. But it's not so much that you're totally dependent on this human medical system. But anyway, getting back to your point about the healthcare costs rising, I mean, like I said, 18% rise each year in healthcare costs. Now, is that because doctors and healthcare providers are making more money and they're billing more and their prices are going up? That's not at all true. If you look at, for instance, ophthalmology, which I'm most familiar with, we were doing cataract surgery back and during my training, so that would have been 1985. In 1985, cataract surgery was about $2,000 to $2,500 per eye to perform the surgery's fee. Mm-hmm. That was the surgeon's fee. Now surgeons in Colorado are reimbursed $500 for the same operation, okay, even with better equipment. So our costs have decreased substantially in terms of what we charge to provide that service. Now, how does that explain it? It's the same with, like, LASIK. Okay, look at LASIK. When I first started doing LASIK, it was about $5,000 for both eyes with less, you know, superior technology than we're using right now. And now the cost for LASIK is, you know, about $4,000. So over a period since 1998, LASIK costs have been flat or decreased. Again, that's due to free market forces and the ability for people to go out and shop and decide, you know, I'm going to get the best surgeon for the least amount of dollars. And, you know, it's easy for people to shop for LASIK surgeons. They know how to do that. Okay. And we could do this with all our healthcare. But instead, what we're doing is we're supporting Ma Bell. Like I said, the example in the 60s, where we had this one telephone giant conglomerate that charges you, you know, I remember our long-distance bills. I mean, it was $100 for me to talk for a few minutes from Columbia, Missouri to St. Louis, Missouri. And then MCI came along and broke up that monopoly, basically. And this is what we need in healthcare. We have, like, in the state of Colorado, four large insurance groups. They charge whatever they feel like. They go to Congress. The more power that we put in the government to take over our healthcare system, the more they squander it on lobbyists. And it's not going to our healthcare.
Okay. Now, if we had a politician in here to put a spin on that, wouldn't the politician put a spin on it that would say, well, yeah, look, we've forced their prices down. You know, we've cut them back. We forced their prices down because we were doing it for you, the people.
But I'm not sure whose prices you're saying. Are you saying the healthcare providers, our prices are forced down because essentially how healthcare prices work in this day and age is Medicare sets a fee for a procedure. So like I said, it's $500 for surgeon fee to cataract, period. You cannot bill the patient out of pocket for more of that. You know, if you charge more, you can't do it. That is just a typical fee. Then what happens is the private insurers come along and go, well, we're going to pay you 110% of what Medicare pays. So instead of $500, they'll pay you $600. And you have to accept it. So there's really no free market forces. So the fees are driven down, but why is it rising at 18% a year?
Well, that's the point, and that was where I thought you were going to go with it, is that if, you know, when the politician says, well, you know, we're doing this for you, it's because we care about you, we're keeping all these greedy doctors, you know, prices down for you, then
right.
Then somebody needs to educate the average person to say, no, they're not, because by the time you add on, as you said, the 18% per year increase and the administration of the insurance company is added on and the administration of the government oversight is added on.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that we're actually paying more, you know, and that's where I think people are confused. And that's why you have half the country that is out there saying, you know, thank you for saving us from all of these, you know, evil doctors that are overcharging, when that's not the case. But, you know, somebody needs to be able to show the true amounts that are going on. And you know what? If we'll hang on for just a moment, if I can do this, I think we have a call coming in.
Okay.
And let's see if I can do this. If not, I'll have to call you right back. But here we go. Add to conference. Hi, you're on with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Craig Beyer. Okay, I'm putting add to conference, and hi, you're on with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Craig Beyer.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask two quick questions. This is fascinating. First, I want to find out, you know, the little urgent care kind of clinics that are popping up? I wanted to see if Dr. Beyer had a comment about those. Are they going to last? Are they going to succeed? Seems like they're expanding. And the other question is, are there any other countries that are doing it right that, you know, we could look to pattern our healthcare future after?
That's a great question.
Thanks so much. I wanted to stress throughout those two questions.
Okay. I think I'll start with the second question first about other countries. I think that you really have to look. I mean, you just can't take one model that works for one country and fit it to another country because they're just the demographics. Everything is different. For instance, everyone says, well, why can't we be like Canada? Well, first of all, Canada, I mean, we buy 30% of our oil from Canada. So they make like $300 billion a month just for natural resources coming out of the ground. And they have a much smaller population than the United States. And with that kind of income, they can afford to squander healthcare dollars. And they literally do. So they basically do have the healthcare system, but it's totally inefficient. And when I talk to people that both provide and also receive healthcare services in Canada, it's a terrible system. It's clogged up with a lot of people that abuse the system, that basically, you know, don't really need to be in the emergency rooms or don't need to be in the hospital for a mild cold. And therefore, people that really need something like a heart transplant or something that's really serious, they have to come into this country to get it done. So that's basically part of this moral hazard. If people perceive that they can have unlimited of anything for free, it's going to be abused. Now, and so I can't really think of any country that would fit what we need here in America. All I can do is prescribe what I think would work best for the United States. Now, in terms of these urgent care clinics, I think they're filling a niche, and they are popping up, and I'm seeing a lot of them, and I think they're going to become even more popular as my plan. I really think that my healthcare plan, I think what I'm suggesting in the book, is going to probably happen just out of financial necessity. In other words, it really will cut costs. It'll put people back in control. And I think regardless of what our politicians do, unless they outlaw health savings accounts, we will be able to turn this whole thing around just through free market forces. And I think these urgent care clinics are sort of one of those steps where instead of going to a hospital where there's all these expenses built on top of expenses, you can walk into an urgent care clinic with a cold or whatever you need to be treated for. I mean, there are colds that do need treatment. If it's strep throat, you need to be treated, and that would be the place to at least get screened for strep throat and decide if you need to be on antibiotics.
Can I just say one other question?
Sure.
I know a lady whose daughter has six children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just kind of laugh that she doesn't work, she smokes, she sits around drinking Cokes and collecting welfare.
Right.
And she has free health care. So if the kid sneezes, she's off to the emergency room. And I'm not trying to take lightly that maybe her kids may have colds and things like that. But, you know, a lot of the other people I know can't afford to go because they don't have health care. But yet our welfare system is way out of whack. So, you know, I mean, to me, this is just abusive that every time she stubs her toe, she's heading to the emergency room and she never pays a dime for anything.
Yeah. Welcome to the Canadian healthcare system on a large scale.
That's right here.
Yeah. And so what happens is that, you know, my book talks about this, and I totally believe that there should be a safety net for people that can't afford insurance, but it has to be the type that is it can't be the level that you are at. Let's say people that want to take care of their health, it just doesn't work. You can't mix two types of patients, and there definitely, as a doctor, I see two types of people. There are people like myself and probably yourself and Alan on the phone here, where we actively participate in trying to stay healthy. I know Alan says he does yoga, so that's a good start. And I hope he eats properly too. But anyway, all these things are really the most important. Exercise, eating properly, watching over your health are more important than anything. 75% of all illness in this country is preventable. And 5% of the population, actually less than that, use up over 80% of the healthcare dollars. So if you see, look at that and say, wow, these people are really self-inflicting illness. And if we just give them health care for free, it does sort of look like, well, what's their incentive to take care of themselves? But really what it comes down to, like I said, you can't change that. You're going to have people that are actively taken care of, and some people, because of psychological behavioral disorders, you'll have people that are alcoholics or they're homeless and they're psychotic, they have some sort of mental illness. Those people are not going to go to a yoga class, and they're going to be addicted to drugs or something, but they don't fit in the same healthcare system that you and I fit. When someone that's addicted to drugs walks into an emergency room, we can't fix it as a doctor with a 20-30 minute office visit. That's a major problem. So they need to go to a behavioral clinic. They need to have other issues. They need a separate tier of medicine. And to put the three of us into that same emergency room where that drug-seeking behavior is, it doesn't work. You're combining two people in one system that doesn't fit all. So that's one of the strategies I'm saying in this book, is that we need things like government-run institutions or even medical schools where we can send people that are homeless or they don't have funds, that they can get treatment for free, that they're subsidized by the government, and it's providing benefits for medical students and educators and things like that and helping these people. But for people like us who want the best possible care, we should be able to go out and get it.
That's absolutely. Listener, thank you so much for your question. We're going to take a break now. And again, we are talking about heaven or health. Our guest is Dr. Craig Byers. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Dr. Craig Byer, and we are talking about the U.S. healthcare system. So when we went to break, Craig, we had some great questions that came in, and I mean, you were talking a little bit about kind of preventative types of things. You mentioned about yoga and things like that. You also mentioned that you sort of have a plan, and if we have any politicians out there, I hope they're listening. So that we can put some sort of an alternate plan out there that may be able to help. Tell us a little bit about your views of the current healthcare trends and how your plan would be better than that.
Okay, let me preface that a little bit with, I just pulled up this chart to just review this. So we were talking about 18% rise in healthcare costs every year. And I just pulled up this chart that shows what are the profits of the insurance companies in the United States. Well, I've got the top 10 profit, and I've got just for 2009, but for WellPoint, which is the number one, $4,746,000,000 in profits, okay? United Health Group, $3,822,000,000 in profits. Cigna, $1,302,000,000 in profits. Aetna, $1.3 billion. Humana, $1 billion. AARP, $500 million. So those are the top. And so you can see those profits are just enormous. Okay? This is profits. These aren't revenues.
Right.
And so I think you can get an idea of when you look at cardiology groups and everybody, all the physicians and people, the providers that are really taking a hit, it's not, the money is not going to them. And so how can we preserve quality? I mean, preserve a system that will you know, propel this in a sustainable way going forward, I think we have to look at how basically the LASIK model works. I mean, LASIK has been great in terms of advancement in technology. Like I said, when we started in 1998, we used a blade to make a flap. Now we use a laser to make the flap. We have custom technology that makes a much better ablation on the surface of the eye. And all of this is due to the fact that it's free market and we've been able to improve. Now, on the other side of the coin, if you look at a government-run system like Medicare, where cataract is reimbursed at a fixed amount and you can't ask for any more revenue from the patient, basically, we have cataract surgery. And I'll give you an example here. With cataract surgery, you can do it with a scalpel, and it's been done that way for years. But now we can do it with a laser. There's a new femtosecond laser that adds a significant degree of safety to the procedure and predictability. But guess what? That procedure costs about $2,000 per eye to do, and Medicare doesn't cover it. You know, they don't pay for that technology. They pay $500, period, no matter what technology you use. Now, if you went to the patient and said, do you want the scalpel or do you want to pay $1,500 extra to have the laser? Well, if it were my eye, I'd say I'd pay the $1,500 and
sure.
I'll have the laser. Right?
Sure.
But it's against the law. You cannot charge a Medicare patient for that laser. So that billion-dollar technology, which is developed over a period of, you know, probably a decade, is probably going to wither on the vine because there's no way to pay for it, you see?
Right.
And that's because we have a single-payer Medicare system that mandates all seniors over 65 participate in this system that has explicit rules and benefits.
Right. And a system that what you're saying is not going to allow us to not only not use technology that's already there, but who's going to spend the money for the research necessary to keep us on the cutting edge the next time or whatever the next newest thing is.
That is exactly right. And I had a rude awakening this past summer. I remember my first time to Europe was back in 1979, and I remember going to a French ophthalmology clinic, and I'm like, boy, this is like the dark ages compared to where we were in 79. And now this time, I was there just last fall, and they are so far advanced now in terms of where they're going with ophthalmology. And it's basically they set up a private paid clinic just like what the outside of the socialized system, like I had to do in China to allow that technology to keep going. Now, here is the solution. So a lot of people, well, how do we afford healthcare? Well, first of all, people have no idea that healthcare is much less expensive than they really think it is. So most of the time when you get a hospital bill and they have this huge bill, they're thinking, God, there's no way I could afford it. Thank God I had insurance. Well, I'll give an example. I had a person that was working as a technician in my office, and it's, you know, it's like an independent contractor, and he was telling me the story how he had a kidney stone, and he had a $25,000 hospital bill, and it was a one-night stay. So I'm like, are you kidding me? Did you pay it? And he said, yes. And I said, well, you shouldn't have paid that because you could have negotiated that. In reality, what that bill would have been paid for by an insurance company for a one-night stay in the hospital, it usually is about $1,000 to $1,500, and the doctor who removed the kidney stone through ultrasound was probably paid $1,500 as well. So the total amount of dollars probably transferred in a usual transaction like that is like $3,000. If he would have walked into the hospital and said, here's $3,000, take it or leave it, they would have taken it, okay? But so people don't understand that these bills that they get are marked up, and this is called something called a bill master, and every doctor and every hospital does it because they are paid a percentage by insurance companies of their usual and customary fee. So let's say you usually charge a dollar for something,
mm-hmm.
and the insurance company says, well, we're going to pay you 10% of your usual customary fee. Well, wouldn't you say, well, I better charge $10 then so I can get my dollar? You see what I'm saying?
Gotcha. Yep.
And that is what's happening. So people get these bills that are 5 to 10 times marked up what they usually are when they're not really, that's not what the hospital would accept or usually gets paid. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, so, but let me ask this then. Then why can't we have, I mean, some organization that's large enough, be it the AMA, with the American Medical Association, if they, you know, partnered with just about every other medical association that's out there, and if they got together and if they wrote something up that said this is what this is what we need to get paid for these procedures. This is what we need to do. We can put together a system that cuts out all the middlemen and be able to show that, you know, if you have it, and I think you mentioned it in your book, but I think that our, I think you said that the percentage, it's a $2.5 trillion annual healthcare budget. So if that's the case, then if they can come and put something together that says, look, we can do this for, for $1 trillion instead of $2.5 trillion, we can.
Well,
do
there's
this.
A lot of factors, I think it, it's hard to centralize fees like that. And let me just give you an example. First of all, like you're saying, on this cost of the $2.5 trillion, that really breaks down to about $8,000 per patient per person per year in the United States, which is just ridiculous because in reality, the average dollar spent per person per year on healthcare is $180. So there's a lot of money that just seems to be gone. Okay. And keeping that in mind, and this is where I was going to before, like what is every procedure that I provide in ophthalmology, there is not one procedure that we do that's over $5,000. And for most people with a health savings account, and that's where we're going to go with this and why this works, you can afford to pay that out of pocket, $5,000. And like I said, that is, that would be like the Cadillac procedure, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And most doctors, I mean, ophthalmology is a surgical profession, so surgery is more expensive than most other types of office visits.
Right.
And so, like I said, this is really the top end of what typical fees are. I mean, if you're talking about cardiovascular surgery or something like that, then you are going to be hitting those bigger numbers of $10,000. But even that would be a very catastrophic problem to have to go on and get, coronary artery bypass surgery or something, okay? So, but like I said, if you're allowed to save and you can shop, and this is what's really critical, and no one understands this in medicine, if you are a Harvard grad, let's say you're a medical student, you went to Harvard Medical School, you went to all the top schools, and you can imagine what that costs to go to a school like that. And I have, fellowship applicants that are just incredibly qualified, and they're hundreds of thousand dollars in debt. You know, they can be up to $300,000 in debt by the time they get out of medical school. Now, why is it that this student who's worked so hard to get into Harvard and go to the best ophthalmology programs and fellowship training programs, he gets paid the same for Medicare as an optometrist who doesn't even go to medical school for an office visit? You see what I'm saying? This is where you have to be able to make decisions as a patient. Well, is it worth paying that extra $100 to go to the Harvard grad that has a lot more training, or should I just pay less to go to the optometrist? I mean, these are decisions the patient needs to be involved in. But instead, the optometrist under our current system gets paid the exact same amount as the Harvard grad through insurance companies and through Medicare. So it's totally the same.
Right. And the long-term effect I see in that is that the motivation is not to go $300,000 in debt and go to Harvard. So instead you go to whatever
optometry school. Yeah. For 4 years and that's it.
Yeah. And So again, the bottom line is that we are going to get a lesser care over a period of time. It's we're not going to spend the money on greater technologies. We're not going to spend this. We're literally going to reduce our country and our medical growth to that of sort of the lowest common denominator.
That's exactly right.
And so the patient's
been totally removed from the decision-making process on their health care. And that is because by doing that, that provides a very big margin for the third-party administrators. You see?
Well, let me go back to that statistic that you had because it was pretty amazing. You said it's $8,047 per person. You know, if you take what the annual health care budget is, $8,047 per person. That's per person. That's not even per family, correct?
Right. That is correct. Of every person in the United States.
Right. So now, if you take that and you have a typical family, let's just say that you have two kids, you now have, you're multiplying that, by four. So you now have whatever, $32,000.
Right.
You know, right off the top. There's your, right. You know, there's your cost from that standpoint. And the reality of it is that everybody's not paying for that. So now let's take that even further, because, you know, the myth that says that we have unemployment that is at 8.3 or 8.5 right now, which is just a myth. The reality is we have 58% of our workforce working. Okay.
Right. That's
okay.
True.
Yeah. So that's the reality of it. But again, you have political people trying to tell you something different. So really, when you take those numbers, it's actually a lot worse, because there's only 58% of the people that are actually working and paying that, either through taxes,
yep,
or through our savings or whatever it is that we're using.
Yeah, coming out of taxes, our national debt, and then our insurance premiums. Those three things are paying for that $8,000 per person.
Right, and thank you. You added in the national debt, because that wasn't.
Yeah.
I didn't cover that, but you're right. That's one of the things, and again, it goes to, you know, to the fact that we can't continue to spend $1.43 for every dollar that we're taking in. Any mathematician is going to tell you that eventually is going to crumble.
And I can just show you right off the bat, I mean, just for my own family of four, how much money I've saved. I was paying, and just really didn't pay much attention before, but I was paying for traditional insurance family of four close to $18,000 a year. So it was about mm-hmm. $1,600 a month premium.
Yep.
And that's traditional. And like I said, I get these bills all the time at the end of the month. Even with that type of coverage, I get, you know, you have to pay the $45 copay. Then I get a bill that, you know, this was not covered under your insurance plan. So I get maybe a $200 bill or a $300 bill there. So in reality, I was probably paying over $20,000 a year for health care for the family. And, you know, or close to it. But, you know, what I ended up doing is I just recently, now before I had a $5,000 last year, but I just switched now to a $10,000 deductible plan for a family of four. And what's really nice with this plan is with the $10,000 deductible, my insurance premium is now $500 a month. And under, you know, the law, you can put away for a family of four $6,600 a year into a health savings account pre-tax.
Mm-hmm.
So look how much I'm saving. I mean, basically, I'm paying $500 a month premium, which equates to about $6,000 a year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For catastrophic. And that premium covers 100% of any expense over $10,000. So if I got hit by a bus, I'm fully covered, right?
Right.
Now, and that's up to, like, I think the lifetime benefit was like $3 million. So what are the odds of me using $3 million of catastrophic insurance over my lifetime? Pretty unlikely. But anyway, now the rest, so of that, instead of paying $20,000 a year, I'm paying $6,000 a year. That's $14,000 a year in savings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of that $14,000, I can take $6,600 and put it in a savings account. So you can ask me now, well, how much of that $6,600 did I spend last year on my family? Probably about $800. So you can see that it's a huge amount of savings, and every year it rolls over. So you can add, at the end of this year, I'll have $12,000 in that account.
Right, and what you're saying is, and you can put that in there tax-free.
Yeah, and the thing that the beauty of this whole system, and I'm so glad someone thought about this years ago, I mean, the concept of the HSA, but the beauty of it is that you can go online and say, I'm going to go to the Harvard doctor and pay him out of my HSA credit card $200 for an office visit instead of going to the optometrist and paying $100. I mean, you can make that decision. Or I can use this for LASIK surgery, or I can use this for things that make me better, not things that are just for when I'm falling apart. You know what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying? So, and there's just all types of examples like this where, you know, you might want to spend it on a chiropractor just to be adjusted. You might want to go to an acupuncturist. Things that help you if you get a cold, a viral infection that's not treated with antibiotics, acupuncture helps, you
right,
know?
Right, right. And all of these things are things that you're saying that we should have in a free society. We tell the world that we have a free society. How about we prove that we really do, you know?
And I take it one step further. You know, right now you're not permitted with your HSA to buy a health club membership. But I'd say, why not? I mean,
mm-hmm.
if it costs $100 a month for a health club membership and I can pay it out of my, you know, an athletic club, out of my HSA, it makes total sense because that's what's keeping us alive. Or if I can buy organic food with my HSA, or buy things that are healthy, certain foods. These are all things that are going to save our society tons of money.
Oh, yeah. And now you're touching on another little pet peeve area when we go into the area of entitlement in food stamps and people that are figuring out ways to get alcohol and
right.
potato chips and everything else, and Twinkies,
right.
With their food stamps, when that's not making them healthier. That's actually making
right.
them less healthy, which means they are going to have more health problems. So we aren't doing them any good, nor are they doing themselves any good.
And like I said, we're not going to be able to change that behavior overnight, and we're not going to be able to just let them out in the streets to wither. I mean, I think we need to be able – that's why the two-tiered system is there. I mean, what the government is proposing for all of us, which is basically a basic health care plan where, we're going to tell you what kind of care you're going to get, that should be for the people who have no choice.
Right.
But for people that are functional income earners and trying to do what's best for their lives, it just doesn't seem fair.
Yep. I know what you mean. Now, you were talking a little bit about the healthy foods, and I know in the book you mentioned it's sort of like, socializing, healthy food, personal trainers. Give us a little more of your information in regards to that, because it's one of the things that I like, and it has to do with the fact of preventative measures. There was nothing that I've seen, in the healthcare bill that was set up, the healthcare bill that we're being stuck with, that is set up for anything that is preventative measures that are going to make us a healthier society.
You are so right. I am 100% in agreement with what you just said. I reviewed the healthcare bill, and there are preventative tests that are covered 100%, and this is just another thing for total abuse. Basically, they'll pay for a cholesterol screening and they'll pay 100% for that, which makes sense. Cholesterol is an important thing to monitor. But do they pay for anything to help you figure out how to get your cholesterol lower, like exercise and diet? Or is
right.
there, there's no incentive for that, like you said. So really the way the system is set up, it's just like the way Medicare in the early, when Johnson first established Medicare in the late 60s, actually Harry Truman was the first Medicare recipient. But anyway, when President Johnson established Medicare, he went to the doctors. I mean, the AMA and the physicians were quite, and I hate to put AMA and physicians in the same category because, AMA at this point really doesn't represent physician interest. They make their living through insurance premiums and everything else too, just like AARP. But anyway, the physicians were basically told by Johnson, well, this isn't really going to be socialized medicine, because they were really getting fearful that we were going to go into the Soviet-type system where, the government's just going to pay them a fixed fee and that was it. But Johnson told them, it's not. We're going to cover 100% of the Medicare costs for seniors, and you can bill whatever you want. So you can imagine how that was abused, right? I mean, the seniors could get anything they wanted without paying a dime, and the physicians could go ahead and do anything they wanted to these seniors and get paid whatever they felt like billing, right?
Right.
So it's basically you circle a code on a piece of paper, and you can get paid a lot of money. Of course, that system was completely abused, and Medicare was just spending so much money that ultimately they came up with the way Medicare is now, which is totally the opposite direction. But because of that, physicians would do unnecessary procedures. They would do things called unbundling, where they would make up billing codes. Like instead of doing cataract surgery, it'd be an incision for cataract surgery. Then it would be an iridectomy for cataract. You know what I'm saying? They just kept
right.
adding more and more bills to the same total procedure. And now you can see they don't even learn from their mistakes. Okay, now the government's paying 100% for cholesterol screening. Well, I mean, can you imagine everyone in there? We'll just set up a cholesterol clinic and just screen everyone, no matter if they need it or not. They're going to get paid.
Well, exactly. I know, and that's part of the frustration that you just brought up is that they put in what would be considered preventative tests and stuff.
Right.
But just the test. In other words, let's focus on the things that would keep us from getting worse or keep us from getting to that point to begin with.
Right.
And if we can do that, I mean, we can really make this country a healthier country, and we really should be focusing on quality of life.
Right. Yeah, it's just abominable. I mean, I really, like you can see, you're stirring up my emotions why I wrote this book.
Well, and Craig, I got to tell you, we are very glad that you did, and I can't believe the time has gone by. Again, for anybody, if you want to pick up this book or you want to go to the website, learn more about it, it's www.heavenorhealth.org. Dr. Craig Beyer, again, thank you so much for doing this, and please stay in touch. You know, I would love to know more if you write more on this. I think it's something that it's information that needs to get out. And for all of you that are listening, talk to your congressman, talk to your senator, send them information, tell them what you want, because if we don't tell them what we want, we're going to get what they want to give us.
Totally agree.
All right, Craig, again, thank you, and everybody, keep listening to not only the next show, but make sure that you're back next week for Answers for the Family. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.